Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Organic Grower School, offering a holistic crop management series for farmers starting on March 23rd. Learn more at organicgrowersschool.org.
This week on Meat and Three, we continue our trade series with a piquant look at the many faces of the spice trade, from the high price tag of saffron to the ubiquity of chilies and the potential ripple effect that farmer protests in India may have on the global spice market.
You know, farmers are protesting because they feel like their lives and livelihoods are on the line.
You find it in a lot of cured foods, like cured meat and Parmesan cheese. You also find it in ripening foods, like ripe tomatoes are very high in MSG. So there's sources of it all over the natural world.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and today we're going to be talking about price fixing. I'm really excited to have Peter Carstensen back. He has been a guest in the past. He joined me to talk about the dairy industry a couple of years ago, but he is, in case, for those of you who don't remember, and in fact, his CV is so impressive that there's no way you could keep it all in your brain. He is a professor of law emeritus. From 1993 to 2002, he served as Associate Dean for Faculty Research and Development at the University of Wisconsin Law School. He is a graduate of the University of Wisconsin, received his law degree and a master's degree in economics from Yale University. And from 1968 to 1973, he was an attorney, listen up, people, at the Antitrust Division of the United States Department of Justice, assigned to the evaluation section, where one of his primary areas of work was on questions of relating competition policy and law to regulated industries. So you can see he is the Mac Daddy on this subject. He has been a member of the faculty of the University of Wisconsin Law School since 1973. He is a senior fellow of the American Antitrust Institute. We love you. And he is also the author of Competition Policy and Buyer Power, which I think came out in 2017. Is that right, Peter?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining me on the show once again. I'm very excited to chat with you. I've been, as I said to you, I think before in my email, our email exchange, that I had, in fact, been following this antitrust or rather price fixing, I guess you could call it a scandal, in the poultry industry for some years now. And so it has been the subject of an ongoing class action suit since 2016. And in the class action suits, it is alleged that the price fixing has actually been going on since 2008. So first, if I could ask you to describe what brought about the class action suit in the first place, then we'll move on into the federal investigation.
Okay. Just a lawyer's quibble. The effect of the alleged conspiracy is to raise prices, but it is not a conspiracy that is claimed to be a, quote, price-fixing conspiracy. In these products, there are so many different uses that it's really very hard, really very hard for alternative firms to agree on, you know, an enormous price agenda. What they can agree on is to restrict output. If you cut the amount of supply, you're going to raise prices generally. So it's sort of a technical point, but it explains at least part of what's going on. The case gets brought in 2016 after lawyers had spent some substantial amount of time, I assume, investigating and evaluating the merits of a possible claim. The role of agristats in coordinating information about supply characteristics in the poultry market was known for several years prior to the bringing of the lawsuit. Some of us, myself, some other economists I know, kept saying, how can they do this legally? How can they possibly have this kind of coordination of information about supply?
Great question.
Legally. And it took a significant investment of time and effort by a set of lawyers to figure out exactly how to frame the case and to gather the necessary evidence, because the way modern antitrust law of this sort, class action antitrust law, is practiced, courts require you almost to prove your case with your complaint before you've had any chance actually to do any serious discovery. Now, that's an exaggeration, to be fair, but you've got to have a lot of evidence that you, or evidentiary claims, that's a better way to say it, at the front end. So it took a while for this case to get put together. And so it gets filed in 2016. I don't know the timeline. My guess is they were probably working on that for at least a year in preparation.
Yeah, I would think so. And then the class action suit morphed into a federal investigation. And I guess that was, I guess, in the last 2 years or something. I couldn't quite identify when the class action suit turned into an actual DOJ investigation. But my understanding that it was at the very end of the, like around maybe 2017 or 2018. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, I think it's 2018. I couldn't find the exact date either. And it's morph is not quite, again, the class action continues. What happened was that at some point, the antitrust division lawyers said,
of the Department of Justice,
began a serious interest in this case. And the way it surfaced was with a request to the court where the civil lawsuit is going on to suspend discovery in the case to allow for a federal investigation. There was a period of about 6 months or so when the civil case was suspended. The feds were conducting an investigation. I think it was both civil and criminal. Those are two different parts of the antitrust division. And interestingly, they don't talk to each other.
That is interesting.
The criminal side, and this is because of a set of rules. You can't use your criminal investigation to support a civil investigation or case. So you've got to keep them pretty separate. What we know is that there was a period of inaction on the part of the private lawsuit. And then things were resumed. Discovery was resumed. Things were proceeding towards the next stages of litigation. And then this fall, the criminal part of the Justice Department brought criminal indictments against several Pilgrim's Pride executives, including, I think, the CEO of Pilgrim's Pride. Pilgrim's Pride is owned by JBS Swift. And so I think it's three individuals were criminally indicted. It was pretty clear that if you read the complaint, that there were a lot of other individuals who were implicated, as were the corporation, Pilgrim's Pride, Tyson, and others. The specific charges were for bid coordination, price coordination. This was actual price fixing. How much were they going to charge, or what would be the base price? What would be the discounts in sales to specific buyers? And what it illustrated was why the broader claimed conspiracy involved controlling output, not trying to control price, because it gets awfully complex. If you look at the indictment, the back and forth about, do we discount this 4.75 cents on the dollar, or do we discount it 4.78 cents. And you're talking about such a huge amount.
Sure. I mean, we produce 9 billion chickens a year in this country.
So. Right. And each chicken several pounds. So you think about that. Even in the tenths of a cent, you wind up with an enormous amount of money involved over the whole universe. So the government came in with that lawsuit. What that tended to confirm was that there really was a lot of bad acting going on. And that's when things began to unravel in terms of the defendants beginning to settle cases much more actively. The big fine that Pilgrim's Pride paid and that Tyson has paid on top of the civil liabilities that are being negotiated.
Wow. So there's both a civil liability issue and then the criminal the fines that they, for example, the $110 million in fines when Pilgrim's Pride was actually found guilty or pled guilty to the price fixing and they paid the $110 million in fines. But I was going to ask you that is like, there will be further financial repercussions from the civil suit that's going forward sort of in tandem with this criminal suit. Is that correct?
That's correct. And again, technically, I suspect that Pilgrim's Pride pled no contest rather than guilty, because if you plead guilty, that becomes evidence that you violated the law, and there's still a lot of cases hanging out there.
I see.
If you plead no contest, the plea cannot be used in subsequent civil litigation. The fact that all the information, all the evidence that you gave the government becomes discoverable and usable. And so it may be a distinction without much of a difference in a case like this, where the civil plaintiffs were several years ahead of the government.
Right, which they were, right.
Usually in these cases, the government brings the criminal case and then the plaintiffs come in and sue. And there, the no contest plea followed then by, okay, now we've got to do the discovery and prove our case separately, you see, becomes more of a burden.
Yes.
Here, the plaintiffs already had the evidence.
I see. So let's just kind of roll this back a little bit so people can sort of catch up with where we're at here. So the price fixing that was first initiated by, as what you alluded to, is the class action suit, that originated from one particular Maple Vale Farms, which claimed that prices to them, I guess they're a sort of intermediary, were being manipulated by supply and demand. But then also there was price fixing in terms of the price per pound that they were paying to the actual contract farmers who were raising the birds, if I'm not mistaken. And then that also had an impact on the prices that consumers paid. So, you know, this is actually a very, you know, multi-pronged or a multi-faceted effort to bilk just about anybody who could be cheated. It was a very coordinated effort. And you alluded to agristats. And agristats, let's just, tell people what that is. That is a service that provides information about, well, I don't really understand they're providing stats about how many birds are being grown or what the prices are being grown. Why is that legal? I mean, you alluded to the fact that that was potentially illegal. Why is it legal?
Yeah. Okay. And we need to come back to who all got harmed, but let's start with agristats. Agristats is what we'd call an information coordinator. If you want to make markets work, buyers and sellers need some knowledge. They need information. They need to know how much is there, something about prevailing prices, so you're not sitting around in complete ignorance. So that's the importance of information if you want to have a workable market. What agristats offered was a confidential service. Only those that subscribed to the service and agreed to keep the information confidential could participate. They then set up standardized information forms so that everybody was giving information in the same format. They consolidated that information, and it wasn't just the number of chickens, the number of laying hens. It was everything that was going on in these companies in terms of supply, sales, prices, etc. So, and then they put this all together and shucked it out to all of their subscribers. You got to tell what your plant was or your company. And then supposedly, to preserve, quote, confidentiality, unquote, all the other suppliers were given numbers, you know, number one, number two, number three.
I see.
The thing is that if you know the industry at all, everybody seems to agree that it would be no challenge to figure out who number two is, who number three is.
Of course, because we're talking about the four biggest poultry producer or, you know, marketers in the country: Tyson, Pilgrim's Pride, Sanderson's, and Perdue, right? There were other people involved, but they I mean, so you're right. It wouldn't be hard at all to figure out who, you know, Tyson is number one, Perdue is number two, right?
Well, but you'd know more about the specifics of plants, what they were doing, what they were processing. Mm. And so now you could tell which plant was doing what. That, then there were a set of more or less public communications by senior management. We really think we need to reduce the supply of chickens because there are too many chickens in the market. We need to increase exports, et cetera. So there are this set of signals given about let's do things that will reduce supply. And then, and they had some target numbers that were given. And simultaneously, you see, they could look at their data from AgriStats and tell whether the other major competitors were doing what they said they were going to do. Were they reducing supply? Were they reducing the number of laying hens? How many chickens were on feed? How many flocks were being put out? How many flocks were being killed, harvested? So that this is central, and you've got an industry, as I talked earlier briefly. This is complicated stuff because a chicken is cut up in for various uses, whether it's buffalo wings at a restaurant or chicken used in various prepared foods, etc., sold to people. So what you can do is you can keep an eye on the total supply. As supply goes down, price goes up. That was the core of the plaintiff's case here. And AgriStats is absolutely central to this because otherwise there's so much static, so much, such limits on what you can tell about what the other guy is doing that it's really hard, unless you really trust your competitor, to be sure that you know that they're really honoring the commitment. Because one of the things is on the selling side, if I can lure the other guy into cutting his production and I don't cut mine, I can steal some of his market or her market, as the case may be. So that you really need, this is the classic trust but verify. And so that's where AgriStats was just absolutely central to this arrangement to reduce production, raise prices to consumers, as you indicated, reduce the number of flocks and therefore the income of the growers. It wouldn't be, they wasn't so much the price paid as the number of flocks. And the way you make money in this as a grower, if you can make money at all, is to have a sufficient number of flocks. And so when they reduce that, that harms the growers. They also, and this is a little bit separate, but again, the AgriStats data, I gather, was important in providing this information. they began to coordinate on the prices they were paying, the wages they were paying to the workers in the poultry processing plants, and were probably engaged. And it's been a while since I read that complaint, but entered into what are called no poach understandings. That is, I won't hire your workers, you won't hire our workers, so we don't compete that way for workers. So yeah, I mean, this AgriStats is at the center of accomplishing all these kinds of harms to the competitive process that hurts producers, it produces hurts workers, hurts consumers.
Right. And let me just ask you this quickly, but AgriStats, do they work with all of the animal protein industries? So this is potentially happening also in pork and cattle?
They offered the same service to pork producers, the hog business,
yep,
and to the turkey business. Oh. There's no evidence that I have seen that they have did this for beef cattle. Beef cattle are a somewhat different
puzzle. It is a different business model, yes, right.
Different animal, if you will.
Yeah.
There is an ongoing lawsuit that has been approved to go forward where the coordination seems to be much more done by the various producers, packers themselves. Now, lo and behold, this is Tyson. This is JBS Swift.
Sure.
So it's the same gang of thugs. Shouldn't call them that. Same gang of pirates.
They are thugs and pirates.
Right. So it's the same gang. They've learned how to coordinate through AgriStats in the businesses where that coordination is most easily done through this kind of data processing.
Right.
Beef packing is different in a variety of ways that may make the coordination easier when it's simply the set of companies doing it because they know so much about what's going on in each other's plants.
Yeah, that's right. And so will AgriStat get any, will there be any blowback on them from these lawsuits? I mean, do they deserve to get in trouble or are they just providing a service and it's up to the players who subscribe to the service to play honorably? But of course, no honor among thieves. But is that sort of the position of the Department of Justice in investigating this matter, that AgriStats is kind of squeaky clean? They just provide a service. You know, it's not their fault that the other guys are thugs and pirates.
I don't know about the Justice Department. Let me say something about that in a second or two.
Sure.
AgriStats is a named defendant in most of these cases. Why? Because it is actively coordinating the conspiracy. There's a long history, actually, in antitrust of an entrepreneur offering coordination services to a cartel. So it goes all the way back. There's an early case called American Column, where there was a trade association and the CEO of the trade association would go around holding, I've always thought of them as revival meetings, telling all the flooring manufacturers, if you will just do what I tell you to do, your prices will go up. And the Supreme Court said, well, he's guilty. Well, not guilty, it was a civil case. He should be enjoined from doing this.
Right.
So on the civil side, AgriStats is in this, I hope, a big way, because but for them, this would not have been possible.
Of course.
The government side, one of my biggest frustrations is that at least so far, we've seen this criminal case. We have not seen the case that the government ought to be bringing, which is against AgriStats specifically for this kind of information exchange. It so clearly violates It seems to me it is clearly contrary to the kind of guidance the government has given on information exchange in other industries and serves only for the purpose of creating the kind of anti-competitive conduct that we've observed. At the same time, I said this earlier, you need to have serious serious coordination. You need to have real information so that people can make intelligent buying and selling decisions. The U.S. Department of Agriculture puts out some of that data. There are various other sources of data in different markets. I always love to tell the story that when I was a lawyer for the Justice Department, I was back for my father's family reunion picnic, the Iowa farm folks. And after we'd eaten, there I was with my little Justice Department badge in my pocket with my cousins who raised beef cattle. And they were talking about future prices. Here's what I think the price is going to be. Here's how to do this. Here's how to do that. I had no problem. I wasn't thinking, boy, I got to slap these guys with a subpoena and get them indicted, because they were trying to be sophisticated sellers in a market where, you know, you've got a pen of 40 cattle. You're not going to affect the price of cattle. What you need to do is understand the market. So this is something that is desperate, where guidance is desperately needed. How much information can be provided to whom, under what circumstances, in order to have workably competitive markets, and the information needs, I should think, to be generally publicly available. And when do you cross a line and that this is not permissible information exchange? And I've been waiting for the Justice Department to do that, and they haven't done it. And I have spoken once or twice to a Justice Department lawyer and said, hey, you guys should be doing this. And then, so I never know whether that means they're thinking about it or no, they don't really want to do it.
Yeah, right. It's, well, you know, given the givens in the way politics works now, and indeed in the most recent iteration of the Department of Justice with William Barr running it, you can imagine that the pressure from the industries on various individuals in those positions, whether it's in Congress or whether it's, I assume not in the Justice Department, but still, you know, pressure is brought to bear about what kinds of guidances and how they're, you know, whether or not things are going to get shut down or fixed or you know, examined in any way. But let's go on for a second, because I just want to point out, as you alluded at the beginning of the show, Tyson has just forked out $221.5 million in a settlement because they actually cooperated with the Justice Department in the beginning of this investigation. And so they are sidestepping any further investigation, is that right? And certainly sidestepping criminal charges. But that's a very big fine. So what does that actually mean about what they were doing?
No good.
Is anyone going to jail?
Mr. Tyson is not going to jail. It looks like none of the Tyson gang, looks like, will go to jail.
Well, they cooperated, right? So that's what they paid for.
As long as they don't screw up in the cooperation. There's been at least one case, I think it was in Ocean Shipping, where they made one of these settlements where they'd come in and spill their guts, only they didn't spill as much as they were supposed to, and the government revoked the immunity and the amnesty and went back and began criminal proceedings aimed at jailing some of the CEOs. Now, I don't remember how that came out. I know there was a lot of concern. So the Tyson folks are out from under on that part of liability. On the other hand, the former CEO of Pilgrim's Pride is looking potentially at up to 10 years in prison. Nobody's ever gotten 10 years in prison for price fixing, but they certainly are sending price fixing executives to prison for several years. Which is not exactly where early retirement usually takes these folks.
So, good one, Peter.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. No, I don't think they expected to have that.
I mean, I figured Tyson must have gone in fairly early when back to 2018 or so.
Yeah.
And said, look, we were involved in a lot more than just the kind of output coordination that is the civil lawsuit. We were involved in essentially bid rigging. price setting with respect to particular customers. And here's what we were doing. Here's the people we were doing it with. Go out and make their day. And that seems to be what went on. And then at that point, of course, the Justice Department is going to look at them and say, you know, guys, you're going to have to pony up something here. So they did. After all, they waited a while. They waited until the Justice Department really had begun an investigation, it looks like. So they're not, you know, it was only, okay, the handwriting is really now on the wall. We better do something. And that's often when there's a rush to the Justice Department door. Hey, can we confess before anybody else confesses?
Well, why haven't the other guys done it? I mean, now that they see that Pilgrim's Pride got, you know, it's had a significant fine, why haven't Sanderson and Purdue also said, oh, well, we're going to cooperate. We didn't really mean to do this. Oh, my God. You know,
like. Well, partly because first one through the door.
Oh, is the one gets the deal. Right. Of course.
Gets the really good deal.
Yeah.
Numbers two and three don't get such a good deal.
Sure, that makes sense.
And, of course, JBS, Pilgrim's Pride, they were in a really interesting box because they were the target. And I don't know. One possibility is, after all, that the Pilgrim's Pride management that was fairly separate from the rest of JBS Swift. Was lying to senior management of JBS Swift. Oh, no, we're not doing anything wrong.
Well, JBS has had tons of problems of their own because the Baptista brothers both went to jail.
So they're a bunch of crooks already.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, the whole outfit is rotten, including the rotten meat send us. I mean, you know, hate them. Yeah.
And it also depends on what your lawyers are telling you.
Yeah.
Now, if the lawyers are saying, look, we've got some good defenses here because this is a really challenging strategic point for the corporation, for the individuals, and for their lawyers. How are you going to handle this? I'm a little, and I think now it sticks in my mind that Pilgrim's Pride / JBS Swift has come forward with some kind of settlement with the government as well. So that now they've reached a point where they had to get out, and this has been one of those things that's been sort of falling for a while. The little guys began to settle early, paying in, you know, $2 or $3 million here and there. In some sense, the handwriting was on the wall for at least a couple of years, really, when the Justice Department came in.
Got involved, right. Yeah, because you can kind of string along a class action suit for a good long while. But I think when the DOJ gets involved, it all happens a lot faster. I've no doubt. What's going to keep these guys from doing it again? Like what, you know, how, once they've paid the big fines and all the dust settles, aren't they just going to go back to business as usual?
Well, that's a real problem. There's an economist, ag economist at, now retired at Purdue, John Connor, who has studied, the compensation that cartels have received compared to the harm that they've caused, the losses that they've caused, and more importantly, the gains that they have made.
Right.
And his conclusion is that in general, a company that engages in cartel behavior winds up net ahead and then has an incentive to do it again.
Sure.
So again, this is where I was talking earlier about the need to have guidelines for the kind of information that can be exchanged. I think in poultry particularly, there are enough competitors that if you could preserve that market structure and restrict the kind of detailed information being exchanged, you have a reasonable shot at having a workably competitive market. But neither, as far as I can tell, USDA, which under Packers and Stockyards Act could do this, nor the Justice Department, which could do it through a civil lawsuit seeking an injunction that would specify what could be done, that would control not just agrostats, but the guys that were buying that information, the Tysons, et cetera, to structure, here are the ground rules going forward. And I should add on this point, because you talked about the politics of yes. Justice Department decisions. It's really interesting because this information stuff is front and center in the Facebook and Google litigation.
Yes, I thought about that when I was developing this outline. I thought, this is exactly the same thing. Yeah.
But here's a somewhat easier, more tractable framework to begin to try to talk about, here's the kind of information that can be exchanged, retained, et cetera. But rather than use that opportunity, at least, and again, we're looking at it from the outside, there doesn't seem to be any effort to use this opportunity to begin to set those kinds of ground rules. And I'm perplexed, given that both the Trade Commission and the Justice Department seem now to have realized information exchange is a really important competitive tool.
Right, right. Very interesting. We're going to take a short break, Peter, like literally a very short break. And we'll be right back with Professor Emeritus Peter Carstensen talking more about poultry price fixing and the giant, whopping, huge fines that are being paid in these various investigations. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Organic Grower School, offering a holistic crop management series for farmers starting on March 23rd. This holistic crop management curriculum and training opportunity is in partnership with Certified Naturally Grown. Growing a viable farm business is sustained by continuous learning of the land and your products. In this workshop series, growers across Southern Appalachia and beyond will gain tools to manage their crop production for whole farm success. Organic Grower School is offering the Holistic Crop Management Training as a 6-part webinar series. It will include a mixture of videos, resources, and live virtual meetings between March 23rd and April 27th. Learn more, meet the instructors, and register now at organicgrowerschool.org.
So now let's talk, because you mentioned this, and I wanted to really dig into this for a couple of minutes. The Packers and Stockyards Act of 1921 is supposed to regulate this exact kind of thing of how large aggregators like Tyson, Perdue et al. Are able to decide on what prices that they pay their growers and basically maintain a competitive market. So tell us a little bit about the Packers and Stockyards Act. And also, wasn't it supposed to be like totally reinvigorated under Tom Vilsack, and somehow that just never happened in 8 years of his tenure at the USDA? I mean, what happened there, and what is the Packers and Stockyards Act for people who do not are not familiar with it?
Okay, a little history here. There was a real problem back, World War I and before, with the 5 major packers, which did both pork and beef, harming farmers, in particular by various kinds of price discrimination, collusion to set prices, low prices, et cetera. Mm-hmm. There was a big investigation by the Federal Trade Commission, 5 volumes, as I recall.
Wow.
Led to a lawsuit by the Justice Department that was settled with an incredible consent decree that actually required the meat packers to sell off. They were going into grocery, retailing, production of various kinds of groceries.
Transportation, as I recall, Yeah.
They were... And they were had to sell their ownership at the stockyards. That's where you used to sell cattle rather than out of the feedlot. Right. And And that, I footnote, it took until 1930 for that decree to actually be fully enforced. But that's Congress thought the decree was inadequate. It did not sufficiently police the conduct of the meat packers, both in their conduct in the stockyards and generally. And so in 1921, it adopted the Packers and Stockyards Act that set up a fairly detailed regulatory set of conditions for the operation of stockyards and imposed a more general requirement that there be no unfair discriminatory conduct by meat packers with respect to sellers of beef and pork. Parenthesis, poultry was not included at this point because there was no public market in poultry. It was a local business. That part of the statute expressly gave the Secretary of Agriculture rulemaking authority, could make rules to interpret what was fairness, what was discriminatory. Fast forward, slowly forward, there were a series of rules adopted mostly focused on the duty to pay, which was a separate kind of issue because you send your cattle and then you wait to be paid. Well, there was a whole series of things imposed on that. And I will say USDA appears to do a pretty good job of enforcing those rules. But the broader question of fairness largely evaporated with the disappearance of stockyards in the 1950s as cattle slaughter, pork processing moved out into rural areas and the buyers went farm to farm. And again, I mentioned my cousins. So this is late 60s. They had three or four, maybe five buyers coming to their farms to look at their cattle. So they had a competitive environment. The opportunity to cheat and manipulate was much limited. Then the industry reconsolidated, and we moved back to a structure that is as concentrated or more concentrated than it was when the Packers and Stockyards Act was adopted. And in that period, neither a Democratic Secretary of Agriculture nor a Republican adopted new rules to police the market. So we come forward to the Obama election, and the new Assistant Attorney General, Christine Varney, had the idea of having, because it was a big issue then, of having a set of workshops on competition in agriculture, co-sponsored by the Justice Department and the Department of Agriculture. Bracket. The Federal Trade Commission was not to be found, a source of continued irritation to me in any event. there was a series of four workshops around the country where farmers raised a whole series of problems. Secretary Vilsack was at all of them. Attorney General Holder was at, I think, three of the four. So, we're really going to do something. At this point, Assistant Attorney General Varney began to bring some lawsuits that challenged cooperatives. The Packers and Stockyards Administration initiated a set of rules making proposals that were really going to restructure, especially poultry contracting. Varney suddenly decided she wanted to leave office and go and do something else because a certain senator from Vermont, who was not an independent, had decided that this was a threat to his client, or so I'm told, a certain large dairy co-op. So the challenge to co-ops went away. The Obama administration made the decision to trade off continued work on those rules against other considerations that they had, other policy things. Politics. You're going to make some trades. So as a result, Congress actually added a couple of additional rules to the set of rules that the USDA already had reflecting poultry, which were steps forward, let it be said. But the broader rulemaking process came to a grinding halt and stayed halted until the end of the Obama administration, when a couple of rules were adopted. That one rule was adopted, I should say. Another was set for final adoption. And of course, Sonny Perdue canceled both of those rules. Meanwhile, and this is where Vilsack really deserves to be faulted, the USDA did nothing to enforce the existing rules, to bring any cases, to pursue any other options that they had, not only in this area, but also in dairy. So many of us are not looking with enthusiasm at his return.
Definitely not.
There certainly is the possibility of returning now that there's a Democratic majority in both houses and the former chairman, the man who had been chair of the House Ag Committee was defeated in the last election, so that the committee is now under very different leadership. So there's a much greater possibility of getting some good rules through USDA, which could include rules about the kinds of information that packers can exchange. And now, starting 15, 20 years ago, poultry is included along with beef and pork in the under the Packers and Stockyards Act. A longer answer than you were looking for, but there it is.
No, not at all. That was actually really excellent, very helpful, and kind of like answered the next three questions in my outline. So that was good. One thing I do want to bring up about this is I often interview a really wonderful rancher named Mike Calicrate, who was...
Yes, I know Mike.
You know Mike, right? So one of the things that Mike was involved in a lawsuit, and I know we're taking us off on a tangent and we really have to wrap this up, unfortunately, but Mike was involved in a lawsuit, and I want you to highlight what this really meant. As I understand it, the burden of proof in charging price fixing in the cattle market amongst packers was, it turned out that you had to show that it was, you couldn't just individually sue the packers. You had to show that their behavior was having an impact on the industry as a whole. I know I'm oversimplifying that. I wondered if you could just clarify that particular aspect of why we really haven't seen any movement in terms of giving relief, say, to the cattle industry, to the cattle producers, I should say. Yeah.
It's an indefensible misconstruction of the Packers and Stockyards Act, which the court analogized to antitrust law and said, therefore, there must be consumer harm.
Right.
And so it can't be just because you were adversely affected on your farm. You've got to show that this affected the price of beef to consumers. That's, I can't use expletives on radio, but you know what cattle put out at the rear end, and that's what this was. But
right.
It's the law right now. The few courts have said that's nonsense. The most respected centrist scholar of antitrust law wrote a little essay saying, what were they thinking? What were they drinking that they would come up with a foolish statement? This is bad antitrust law, and it's even worse Packers and Stockyards law, because the PSA was intended to protect farmers, individual farmers, from discrimination and harm. That all that said, until you get a court of appeals to say the opposite, and then you take a shot at the Supreme Court rethinking all of this and saying, no, courts, you got this wrong, it's going to be more of a problem. Now, I have seen some really interesting cases where a very, very, very insignificant effect on downstream prices was held by a circuit court to be sufficient to cross that line. So there's some possibilities out there that we could, you could see some of this, but it's going to require a kind of litigation argument and a sympathetic set of courts. And I worry a lot about the judges who talk about wanting fair and free competitive markets, but not really believing that in today's world. because they really seem to identify with the big guys and, oh, we don't want to interfere with their freedom of action. And that's the wrong way to think about markets.
Well, it smacks of regulation, doesn't it? And of course, the Republicans are all about, well, we don't want any regulations. We have to let the free market do its thing. Meanwhile, they're driving the rural communities into the ground. And, you know, I mean, eventually, my vision, if these kinds of issues are not suitably resolved, I see farming basically dying in the United States, and we will be importing all of our food from, you know, countries where there are no laws protecting farmers, there are no laws protecting food safety. I mean, this is, to me, is such a crucial aspect of, you know, the agricultural picture writ large, that it's just kind of astonishing to me that more people don't see it from that point of view, and that only the idea that corporations, large corporations, should be making a huge amount of money and be damned to all of the people who are, you know, the little people who are actually doing the grunt work of raising the food. I was going to ask you, if you could wave your wand, what would happen? And then we have to wrap this up, because, as you know, people can't listen to anything for more than like 30-35 minutes before eyes glaze over. So
you see why I tend to my wife tends to run and hide when I want to talk about ag issues.
We'll just have to have you back, Peter, because you've just been a wonderful guest. But
if I had a wand, it would be first to get some of the things I've talked about. We'd get a set of rules out of the Packers and Stockyards Act that would structure these markets. Markets exist under a legal framework. You've got a law of contracts. The Republicans don't want to repeal the law of contracts. They just want laws that run one particular way. So what we need to do is to rethink the legal framework in which poultry, pork, cattle are sold. I'd throw in dairy. As you know, I'm really interested in dairy. Again, USDA's got some handles that it could set some rules for how those markets function that would be fairer, would make for more equitable competitive environment. Secondly, I would go back and look at the structure of the buying side of the industry in pork and beef particularly. I think that you could go back and either undo some mergers or simply say, look, this industry is inherently collusive, and therefore, it's kind of like three strikes and you're out. You guys, it goes back to 1905 was the first time that you were convicted of price fixing.
Right.
enough already. We can restructure this industry. It would be no problem. It would be doable in beef and pork, and each company could have several plants so it could get some economies of scope and scale if there are any in multi-plant operations. And you wind up with somewhere between 7 and 10 competitors of significant size, all of whom would be competing in the market. It would change the world enormously. That's the kind of wishful thinking that only retired professors are permitted to engage in.
And with that, I'm afraid we have to say goodbye. But gosh, this has just been a delight. Thank you so much, Peter. I really appreciate it. And, you know, sure. I hope that somehow your wish list winds up in the Biden portfolio and they take a good look at what you're saying, because it's long past due. So thank you so much for joining me today. And thanks to my sponsor. And we'll see you next week, folks. Thanks for tuning in. And well, that's all for this week. Stay safe. Stay warm. So long. What Doesn't Kill You is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.